Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens. Joining me tonight is Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
And hopefully we'll be joined by Perry Seibert. Tonight's topic of discussion is George Lucas, best known for creating Star Wars and Indiana Jones. He is a proper modern mogul, movie mogul. He's been a producer, a writer, a director, a film student, a special effects guy, head of studio, everything. He's done it all. Done it well, done it poorly, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. What I wanted to start with is, of course, you know, it seems to me that Lucas, he's done just as much producing as he has directing. I wanted to ask, is he a better producer than a director? You know, the films that he just produced or his role as a producer, do you think that he's a better producer than a director?
It's hard to say. I think that some of the ideas that he generates are absolutely brilliant. You look at, for example, the Empire Strikes Back, which he had the broad outline for, but not any script details, or Raiders. Same idea. He had the broad outline and gave the script away smartly. I think that those films he does very well. I think he attaches his name to a lot of crap.
Howard.
Well, that one actually he generated, didn't he? Like, he actually went after that one for some reason.
Yes. But he still attached his name to it. But I know what you mean. I know what mean by, you know, latching on as like just a name, but oh, God.
I'm tempted to say yes. After all, he only had six features as a director, and four of them are Star Wars, and three of those are the prequel trilogy. So,
yeah, I'll be honest. I actually do like the finale of the sequel trilogy. I mean, the prequel trilogy.
Oh, yeah,
I think it's fine.
Revenge
of the Sith is actually a solid entry.
It is indeed. It's just, I do think that he tends to get in his own way. I think that he's really good at the broad strokes. But once details start to get involved, he gets lost in minutia and can't get his head out of his spot.
I think that's part, actually, believe it or not, what happened with the prequel trilogy. I think he had these ideas and he got bogged down in some weird details. I actually didn't mind the midichlorians, but I think that the explanation was crap.
He took something that was always like metaphysical and tried to explain it away with science, which was never going, that was always going to be a hard sell. The intergalactic political intrigue in Phantom Menace is actually captivating. If he had the humility, and frankly, that's what it would have taken, because he was so intent on not letting any of his trusted advisors or peers look at this stuff at all. If he had had the humility to go back to Larry Kasdan and ask him to write the script for this story.
No, instead he went to Carrie Fisher.
I think he would have been a much better film.
Instead he went to Carrie Fisher, and rest in peace, but she's the only script doctor in Hollywood with the reputation she had that must have killed every patient she worked on. Because Jesus Christ, what she did with the second film in that trilogy and the sand line, the dreaded sand line, that apparently is a Carrie Fisher special. Yes. Yep. As Lucas said, I left the romance to Carrie. So, Jesus Christ, that is Carrie Fisher. Yeah, I mean, you know, lots of talents in other ways. You know, she was funny in her little brief bit as the crazy lady stalking the Blues Brothers with a bazooka and a flamethrower and a missile launcher and a tank or whatever the hell it was. I mean, you know, that was a great bit. But I do think that he probably is a better producer in some ways than a director. But, you know, let's just take a quick look at the stuff that and these are the full-length films, excuse me, that he has been a producer on. Star Wars, more American Graffiti, Kagemusha, which even more than Coppola, he was the reason that thing got finished. He was the one that really said, hey, look, we need to put the money behind this to finish this. Empire Strikes Back, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Return of the Jedi, Twice Upon a Time, Temple of Doom, Mishima, which I understand, and I may be mistaken here, and I wish Perry was here, maybe he could correct me, but from my understanding, it was his involvement in that that helped Paul Schrader get that finished. Labyrinth, Howard the Duck, Willow, which was his baby. He did the story for that, of course. Yeah. Tucker, the Man in His Dream, which after One from the Heart, no one wanted to give Coppola any money for a decade or so. And then he did Jack and fucked it up again.
Tucker was his and Coppola's baby from the start, too. Like, that was one they wanted to make back in the Zoetrope days. So that
was
Tucker one
was,
that they
was an interesting
had.
Film. I actually like Tucker. I was going to say that's actually one that he and that's what I and this is what I was going to get at when his best movies as a producer are the ones he also has an interest in, and you know he's interested in cars because look at American Graffiti.
Right, exactly. Well, shoot, look at Star Wars.
honestly, I mean, what are those those sand buggies, those sand racers? Classic cars, old Chevys and stuff. What's the pod race other than some sort of a drag race? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, that's really what it amounts to. And the list goes on and on and on. He's done a lot, and I think that his legacy as a producer is just as big, if not bigger, than that as a director. Although, people say, well, he directed Star Wars. There's nothing bigger than that. Well, maybe not, but at the same time,
and I think there is an argument. I think there is an argument there. His entire legacy as a producer would not have been possible without Star Wars. So it becomes a chicken and egg situation. Like, yes, he's better at being a producer, but his work as a director got him that career.
Yep. Falling upwards. So, we've talked a little bit about this, but I've called him an idea man, and by that I mean he thinks things up, then has others execute him, which, you know, served him well as a mogul and founder of a special effects house. So what do you think of this idea of him as an idea man? You know, the one where, say, he says, I've got this idea for this show. It's going to be this, this, and this. And then he hires people to hire other people to execute that. And they go out and do that. And that's kind of what I'm talking about with his work as a producer. But I'm thinking specifically some of his TV work, which, you know, we're going to get to that in a couple of weeks with the show that we both have pretty strong opinions on. But yeah,
I think that's kind of what I was getting at when I was talking about the Star Wars prequels. Like, the broad strokes are there, the ideas are there, but once he gets down into the nitty-gritty of an actual script or an actual schedule or whatever, he loses it. And part of it is, I think, ironically, his perfectionism. I mean, that's why he keeps going back and tinkering with all the Star Wars movies, right? He can't let them go because he doesn't think they're finished yet. Well, duh.
Yeah, well, but, you know, like, I actually don't mind some of the changes he made. Can we stop here for a second? Just while we're here, before I forget. To go back and touch on this again, but I actually don't personally, I don't mind some of the changes that he made to the Star Wars trilogy. My biggest problem, and, you know, this is where you mentioned his perfectionism, and we're going to talk about this with the TV show in 2 weeks. My problem is where, and this goes into his being a mogul, where he completely obliterates any chance for us to see what it used to be like, rather than allowing an alternate version to exist, or the new version to exist alongside the original. The biggest problem for me with Lucas is his insistence on making the original versions unobtainable. You know,
yes.
And for me, that's a disrespect to a lot of hardworking people, specifically the visual effects artists, and frankly, his wife. I should say his ex-wife.
Yes.
Which maybe that's part of why he did it. Honestly, maybe that's part of why he did it. He wanted to recut the first film in particular to maybe I'm just speculating here. Maybe I shouldn't do this, but I think we've all been through bad breakups. And who wouldn't want to give a big middle finger to our ex?
Especially when, like, I mean, he was an editor, too. That was his first thing.
Yep.
That, like, mm-hmm. before
yeah,
he was a writer,
before
he was a director, he was an editor. And it was Coppola who talked him into starting to write his own scripts. He's like, you've got great ideas. Why don't you start writing these down?
Yeah.
And I get the desire to do it. It's just at some point, man.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta stop or you gotta let it be. Yeah, and you know, and like I said, with Star Wars, I actually don't mind seeing Jabba again. It makes sense. It makes sense. It actually adds a sense of urgency to why Han wanted to get the fuck off Tatooine right then and there. Why Boba Fett was so hot on his trail. You know, people say, oh, well, there's that comedy bit with Han stepping on his tail. Man, that's because Jabba wasn't originally going to be a big slug-like alien. He was going to be a rotund humanoid person, and that's what was going to happen. And so they had to, you know, make the scene where Han walks around Jabba work, because we know what Jabba looks like now. And that's actually totally Han. Of course Han would pull some sort of power move and step on the Hutt's tail. You know, I actually didn't mind that. You know, and some of the special effects are
I know the big one that most fans have just a huge problem with was that, you know, Han shot first, and he changed that in the reissue, and it kind of like, well, we can't let Han be a bad guy. He has to be all white.
That's a big, big issue because it's very clear Han shot first, you know. But there's, you know, and stuff that I don't mind. Again, stuff that I don't mind. And I'm not a fanboy at all, but since we're just discussing this, and I definitely think that's a shitty decision. But, you know, and something, and I've talked about how I think that, you know, going and erasing the work of the original artists was a shame. What I didn't mind was stuff where he added things. And you can still see the work of the matte artists and everybody, but what he's done is he's visually enhanced it with modern CGI, you know, to add things, make the streets of Mos Eisley a little busier, to, you know, connect things here and there so it looks more vivid. That I actually love. And I'm talking mostly the first film, because I think that A New Hope is really the best and worst example of his tinkering.
Yes.
But, you know.
I actually rewatched all of them again a couple of years ago. And I thought, because it's been years, I was probably... They started the reissues in 97, right? In the lead up to Phantom Menace.
Yep. It was 97.
Like, my best friend's older brother had the trilogy on VHS, and I had seen it before the reissues started.
I still have
that
around here somewhere, I hope. God.
But it's been years now, like a good 25 years since I saw what they were originally like. And I was rewatching the newest cut recently and thinking, this is more old school than I remember it being. And I don't know if he went back and added some of those old shots back in, or if he kept more of the practical effects from the 77 that I had remembered. When I first started seeing the reissues. But I thought that he did a really good job, especially in the first one, in New Hope, of integrating new digital effects with the old practical effects.
And, you know, the thing is, I remember so much stuff. Now, I'm a little older than you. I'm a few years older than you. But some of my earliest memories are some of the Star Wars stuff they'd have on TV. And they had a lot of stuff up through about 87, 88 that were makings of the trilogy. And I remember sitting there as a kid watching stuff and seeing Henson's people and Lucas's people, you know, behind the scenes making these elaborate miniatures and puppets and just being wowed. I mean, you know, even as a kid, I knew that they were special effects, but to actually see it being done was cool. And so that gave me
special.
Yeah, it gave me a real appreciation. But the thing is, those aren't available, unfortunately, as far as I know. I can't find them anywhere. At least I couldn't the last time I looked, and it's been a good long while since I've looked at some of those. But the thing is, I wish they put those out. And it feels like it's another thing that Lucas has successfully squashed.
the newest set that has the first six movies. And it has Darth Vader on the cover. Has a ton of stuff from the 70s and 80s. Specifically, like, the actual, like, on-set, behind-the-set special feature, special effects features from 1980 and
1983. I would love to see if it's the same stuff I'm remembering.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the same stuff, but it is definitely archive footage, and it's definitely, like, talking about the process of making the old-school special effects and stuff like that. Like a 9-disc set with the 6 movies and then 3 bonus discs.
So, you know, so yeah, sorry. Well, after that diversion, as we were going, because we were talking about him as an idea man, and yeah, I think this kind of is where this went. But do continue.
I think you see it with at least the original Indiana Jones trilogy too. Thankfully, Spielberg's not as much of a tinkerer, and those were huge hits, so he doesn't touch those. Like, we don't have 6 cuts of Indiana Jones movies.
No.
But it's another place where you see, okay, Lucas and Spielberg came up with this idea together, and they outlined it, and Lucas outlined it a little more, and then he gave it over to Kasdan, who, by the way, is the secret sauce to George Lucas's career. Kasdan,
yes,
turns out a brilliant script, and Spielberg directs the heck out of it. And you have an instant classic. And I think Indiana Jones, even more specifically the first 3 films, that you see that idea man thing even more clearly than in his other work.
Yeah, you know, and I do want to get to this because we've mentioned Indiana Jones, and I don't want to steal too much thunder from what's coming in 2 weeks, because that's going to be another of these two-handers where it's just you and I talking about it. But... yeah, you know, I think that when it's come to Indiana Jones, which I actually, as a whole, I honestly prefer Indiana Jones to Star Wars. And I dearly loved Star Wars growing up, but a lot of the, there's kind of been a level of saturation, I think, with Star Wars that has soured me on it, or maybe just overwhelmed me. I've had some Star Wars fatigue, and let's be frank, the fan base has not been the friendliest place whereas, you know, Indiana Jones fans, I've always found, have been, at least in my experience, they've always been a little more relaxed. You know, most people, even if you don't like one of the movies, if someone else does, they're like, okay, yeah, I guess if it works for you. And even in movies that most people consider the worst, which, let's be honest, most people consider Crystal Skull the worst, I think everybody can admit there's at least one or two fun ideas or one or two good sequences in there. And again, this is an example of Lucas being an idea man. You know, you know, with Indiana Jones, he went and he hired other people. Kasdan, Kaufman, Spielberg, to execute these ideas. That husband and wife team that worked on, God, I cannot remember the names now. I should have it right in front of me, and I don't now. But the ones that did Temple of Doom. And it's just, you know, and then he hired Bowman Hughes, who would go on to do The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. to help him with
Are you talking
final,
about Cats and
mythology.
Yuck?
So many people, so many talented people, you know, and it does beg the question. He's massively talented, obviously, but is his greatest talent in those does his greatest talent come in those moments of recognizing, yeah, I need help. And you said it before, there's been a lack of humility. So has his hubris gotten in the way of his talent?
I think so. I think that Joe McBride is going to knock me down for this, but I'm going to reference the Peter Biskind book. Peter Biskind in Easy Riders, Raging Bull, talks about Lucas specifically and how exhausting it was for him to direct Star Wars because of the perfectionism. And he didn't make another movie for, you know, 22 years. And I think that that experience of just having his butt kicked, it all turned out like he's a billionaire. Like, don't feel bad for George Lucas. But I think that experience of really having his head handed to him taught him a valuable lesson in giving up control to people who are maybe better tempered for the job that needs to be done. And I think that by the time it got to the prequels, built that wall around himself again to the point that he had to go out and try it again instead of letting anyone else touch it. And again, that's understandable too, because all of the stuff between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace that had Star Wars on it was garbage. All of it.
Yeah. It really was. In terms of cartoons and the little films. Now, that's not to say that there weren't some great books, because the books and the comic books, the Dark Horse stuff from the 90s, is amazing.
Yeah, sure. I'm talking the visual, the TV and movies and...
Oh, yeah, the Ewok stuff from the late 80s is fucking terrible. I mean, it just plain is. Sorry,
Wicked for life.
But, you know, now... since we're talking, we've talked the prequels, let's go back there just for a second. I think another problem with the prequels for me is that it took Dave Filoni's Clone Wars series to make the second and third films resonate as deeply as they did, particularly the second one. Now, the third one is still a good movie, but the third one, you know, you see all the Jedi Masters and Jedi in general die, and you're like, oh, well, that's sad. Too bad. Here it is happening. But you don't know them. You watch the Clone Wars series, the CGI series that Dave Filoni did for Cartoon Network, and wow, you actually get to know these characters and care about them over the course of about six or seven seasons. And that was a show that Lucas actually did have some involvement with. And it's actually a really good show. Have you seen it by any chance, or at least any of it?
I started the pilot movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the animation just gave me a really bad headache. I will go back to it one day, but I have not gotten back to it yet. The pilot movie was also just horrendous. I've heard that everybody thinks that, and that the series itself is much better. It's just that to this point, I haven't, you know, worked up to retry.
Yeah. Well, I will say this. When I saw the pilot movie, which was actually released into theaters, I remember thinking, ooh, well, this has potential, but it's giving me a bit of a headache, just like it was, like you said. And then when it became a series, I watched the first few episodes, and I didn't think much of it because, frankly, the visual style was kind of bothering me, and those early episodes all kind of felt the same. But it is a show that I will say, as it goes on, sometime in the second season, the visuals really improve, and they only get better and better. A lot of the problems, really, maybe even from the middle of the first season onward, the visual problems are gone, along with the story problems. It becomes less endless stories of killing or rolling over droids and stuff. And they start to really get into the characters, and they introduce some really interesting concepts. And again, you know, my understanding is that Filoni and Lucas worked together to get some of those ideas out. But again, why couldn't Lucas have done that for the movies? You know, why couldn't he have come up with those ideas in time for the movies and put those in there? And
well,
you know, again,
I mean,
we're talking about his need to give his ideas to someone else to execute.
Yeah, you're also talking about, I mean, Attack of the Clones is too long. Even at 2.5 hours, it's too long. That's because there's too much stuff that doesn't need to be there and not enough stuff that should. The wrong stuff, and I get it. Like, yeah, we want Luke and Leia's origin story too. But, like, if you wanted to tell a romantic story, you probably shouldn't have cast Hayden Christensen. Because if you don't have chemistry with Natalie Portman, you're not living.
I'm gonna I have so much snarky stuff I could say about that, and I don't want to get in trouble. So, you know, let's ask this. What are his strengths as a director? Because, you know, we've talked a lot here about the good and the bad, but let's kind of, you know, talk about one of his strengths as a director. What do you think his strengths as a director are? You know, for me, it's obviously the visuals. I really think he's got a damn fine sense of visual storytelling. I'm just not always sure that it's used in service of the best scripts.
I agree totally. The other thing I would say is that he's also a brilliant student of cinema history and does a really good job of blending genres in a way that feels fresh and not just like slapdash.
Like pastiche or plagiarism,
yeah.
Calling itself homage.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, he's a cut above Leone and Tarantino in terms of that, at least.
Yeah, I mean, Tarantino does it on purpose, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, that's a different thing, but
I don't think that I could ever say Lucas is above Tarantino.
Well, that's why I very specifically said in terms of that, at least.
In terms of Star Wars versus, you know, most of Tarantino's stuff, sure.
You know, we've talked about his failings as a producer and filmmaker, but not the specific failings. So what really are his weaknesses as a director?
He can't direct actors. Cannot. And when he has a really talented actor, you saw it with Harrison Ford in Star Wars. You saw it with Richard Dreyfuss and somewhat with Ron Howard in American Graffiti. And you saw it, with Robert Duvall in THX 1138. Like, the really great actors can rise above his direction. But even a solid actor can get mired down in what he's asking for. And part of that, I think it's that he doesn't direct actors well. Part of it is that he doesn't write dialogue well. And so actors who aren't good at improvising get lost in his script. I get the idea that, you know, if you can say his lines better than he can write them, he'll let you do it. If you can't, you're stuck with it. And so that kind of is where I would say 100% of his issues as a filmmaker come from those two things, that he's not pulling out the best performances from his performers and that he is not great. In fact, at times he's rather bad at writing dialogue.
By myself now?
Have I been raptured? Am I here?
Yep, I can hear you. Are you there?
There we are.
Yep, I don't know what happened there. you know what? I think that I might have toggled both of our phones. I'm not sure how much of that just happened. I think we just had a whole few minutes of dead air. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so sorry for the technical issues. We just had a snafu. Blog Talk muted both of us. So we apologize greatly, greatly for that. So as we were saying after that embarrassing moment, you know, I just want to kind of curl up and not watch Star Wars right now. but we were getting to the next point and the next question It was really more of a kind of a statement and discussion point. And that is it fair to say, as some have accused him, of purposely trying to tear down so-called New Hollywood? It's an accusation that's also been leveled at Spielberg as well. And in both cases, I just don't buy it. I do not buy that it was purposeful. I don't even buy that either man, nor both of them together, are responsible in large or even all that much at all. I am fully convinced that there were other factors beyond their control, such as, oh, I don't know, the corporations figuring out new accounting methods and how to profit off of the new paradigms. Because remember, New Hollywood came about as things were shifting during the TV age, and the old Hollywood system had died. There was the rise of the ratings board, and you had the studio system itself dying, and it took the executives that were left in Hollywood about a decade to figure out how to make money off of it again in the same way they used to without having the exact same system in place. And I think that's much more important than blaming two guys that happen to make big hit movies and saying they did it on purpose. Because that to me just sounds like boo-hoo-hoo.
I mean, yes, without the hit movies, and if we're going to level these charges against Spielberg and Lucas, we may as well throw The Godfather in there too, because was briefly the highest grossing film of all time and did change the way that movies were distributed. Without the hit movies, sure, the studios wouldn't have been able to get the power back. But also without the hit movies, the small movies wouldn't have happened either. So it's classic. It's classic catch 22 here, guys. It no one's to blame except for the suits. The suits are always to blame.
Always, always, and forever. Anon and amen. Yeah. No, that's my take. So, if you had to choose a couple of favorite works by Lucas, what would they be?
Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
If we're including his work as writer and producer, not just director.
We are.
Empire Strikes Back. You might notice a theme here. I'm going to say probably the first Star Wars as well. And I do want to say, I know a lot of people have their issues with THX, and it is very slow and not for the average viewer, especially in the post music video world. But part of me really wishes that he would have stayed on that. I really am curious to see what he would have done with, like, cerebral art house science fiction had he grown into it and not just said, let me try this, and then let everyone in his life talk him out of ever doing it again.
Well, you know, it's funny, even though it's a totally different type of film, apparently Denis Villeneuve said that THX was one of the films he drew inspiration for in taking a brainier approach to science fiction with Arrival. And the thing is, it was based on a, you know, an existing story, but it's quite different from that story. I mean, not completely different, but different enough. But I think that, you know, his desire to find something a little brainier and unusual that doesn't fall on the tire tropes of, you know, lasers and aliens are the bad guys and all that. I can definitely buy that he might be a fan of THX and wanted to do something a little different.
There's a lot of Tarkovsky in THX. I mean, it's a student film.
There definitely
film,
is.
And it's like, you have to remember it's a student film. But, like, it's a student who can also clearly knows what he's doing. Like, he's not there yet, but he's getting there. Like, that's the sense I get watching that film.
We've also discussed here, actually, I need to say my favorites. Yeah, I'm pretty much with you. It's Raiders, it's the original Star Wars trilogy. Yeah, I'm even a fan of Return of the Last Jedi. Fuck it. you know, his older work is his best work. I'm just going to say, I don't hate American Graffiti. It just has never spoken to me the way that it does to other people. I can appreciate it on an intellectual level, but a bunch of white kids in California.
It's a very small town movie.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you don't have
a weird night.
Yeah, if you don't have like some kind of a nostalgia for either the small town or for the specific time, I don't think it's one that is necessarily going to work well. Like, the best stuff outside of the small town material is all very Rebel Without a Cause. And so then you might as well watch Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is a better
really
film,
should.
And I'm not going to apologize for saying that. Like, I think I liked American Graffiti more than you did, but I totally get, like, where your hesitations are. And I grew up in a small town. I still live in a small town. Like, these are kids I know.
I did not grow up in a small town. I didn't grow up in the biggest city around, but, you know, I grew up in a city. I grew up in a city that had about 400,000 to 500,000 people. You know, there were much larger cities nearby, you know, cities of 1 million or 2 million that I visited often. So, you know, I consider myself a city guy. So, you know, that's more my vibe.
right.
So, yeah, you know, I don't have that deep early connection that, you know, maybe is required to appreciate it on a level that makes you go, oh, yeah. I mean, I can appreciate, on one hand, I can understand that, yeah, he really captured something. But it means nothing to me on a personal, deep level. But, you know, we've talked a little bit about his legacy. We're going to get into that in a minute. And we talked a little bit about his influences. But really, what are his influences here?
Oh, my God. So let's start with the big one, the most obvious one, Akira Kurosawa.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars is two Kurosawa films pushed through space opera. It's two Kurosawa films filtered through Kubrick, right?
but if it's Kurosawa, doesn't that also mean that it's a little bit of Shakespeare, a little bit of Dostoevsky, a little bit of
I think she took the Dostoevsky out.
And maybe, but just because it was always there, and a little bit of, well, and I just have to shake my head here, Shakespeare. But if it's also Kurosawa, is it not also ultimately John Ford?
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Again, see, I couldn't hear. Blog Talk, don't you start doing that again.
So yes, Kurosawa, John Ford, Shakespeare. I don't think there's any Dostoevsky in George Lucas's work. We just mentioned Tarkovsky. We also just mentioned Ray with Rebel Without a Cause. He's a student.
You know, I could actually
film.
Really
he,
see a lot of Ray. And Kazan,
yeah,
even, a little.
I also, frankly, don't think you can undersell Francis Ford Coppola's personal influence on him. When George Lucas was in film school, he won a prize that was to go to Warner Brothers lot and watch a film being made. And he walked around looking at a bunch of old guys directing movies and kept walking around until he found Francis making his worst film other than Jack, which is Finian's Rainbow. But he still clearly knew what he was doing.
Oh, no.
And
oh, no.
They struck out.
Oh, no. That film doesn't exist. There is no such film as Finian's Rainbow. It doesn't exist. It is a hallucination of the masses, and no such nightmare exists.
It's a Mandela effect.
We only wish.
And I think they really pushed each other, especially there in the late 60s and early 70s, and Coppola brought out the best in Lucas, and Lucas tempered Coppola's penchant for maybe thinking a little too highly of himself. And they did a lot of good together. Obviously, Zoetrope crashed and burned after a certain point. But that relationship, I think, was very important to both of them.
Yeah, Zoetrope as an original. I mean, it kind of still exists in other forms, but not like it was.
I mean, it's basically Coppola's personal studio now. Like, that's how he funds his own movies, basically.
Right.
Zoetrope as the idea of the new Hollywood revolution crashed and burned.
You know, I think it might have worked.
It was BBS White.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I think it might have worked had they been able to lure people up to the Bay Area to live and work.
Yeah, it's too far.
There with them, but they couldn't. You know, and that's a shame because, you know, there was some talent there, and it was a good idea. But alas.
Yeah,
So, you know, we've talked about the influences here a little bit. You know, I always go back to John Ford. I really do always go back to John Ford, Akira Kurosawa. Now, when I mentioned Dostoevsky, just for clarification, I was talking about Kurosawa's influences, and therefore, you know, Lucas would have encountered that, even though he obviously ignored all Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and all Russian influence in Kurosawa. But the next question is going to be the last one of the night, and that is ultimately, what is Lucas's legacy as a filmmaker? What do you think it is?
for better or worse, it's Star Wars. I will expand on this. Everything he's done in his career has been possible because of Star Wars. Star Wars is still the thing with his name on it that more people see than anything. But without Star Wars, there's no Skywalker Ranch, which is, I'm not even sure if it's an arguable thing. It is the most prestigious sound design studio in the world and has been since David Lynch attached onto it. And David Lynch is the greatest sound design director of all time. And so once David Lynch started doing his sound there, Skywalker Ranch has been legendary. His special effects barn, and you will forgive me for blanking on the name because I'm just kind of going off the cuff at the moment. He sold it.
Are you talking about Dennis Nguyen, or are you talking about Phil Tippett?
The special effects barn?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the CGI one that he sold to Steve Jobs and turned into Pixar.
Okay. I thought you were talking about the main guy that was there, but yeah. Oh, are you talking about John Lasseter?
When John Lasseter was there, I'm talking about the company, though. What was it, ILT?
Yes. I want to make sure you're talking about the company, not a person.
Yeah. He sold ILC to Steve Jobs, and with Steve Jobs' permission, ILC turned into Pixar Animated Studios. Like, without Star Wars, there's no Pixar. Think about that. Most influential animated movie studio since Walt Disney died. Or at least American, because Studio Ghibli, obviously,
Studio Ghibli
is very influential.
But you know, for me, it's the guy is a cultural icon. You know, it's Star Wars, it's Indiana Jones, it's special effects. It's the modern blockbuster, but it's the modern blockbuster when there's. Because let's be honest, the original Star Wars and the original Indiana Jones, there was some thought and there was some passion behind it. You know, I don't think Lucas set out just to make money. I think he set out to make an interesting movie, to have some fun, obviously to make money. But it's what blockbusters used to be, because a blockbuster is not a new thing. There have been blockbusters for decades. There's some blockbusters going back to the beginning of cinema. Any
Birth of a
large hit that lined people up, quote, around the block was considered a blockbuster. You know, The Godfather was a blockbuster. Gone with the Wind was a blockbuster. Wings was a blockbuster. So, you know, I mean, over in Germany, you had things like Metropolis was a blockbuster. Metropolis was a huge hit. You know, it goes back to the idea of these large movies that are entertainments that maybe have a little bit to say that have given way, unfortunately, to a lot of crass and cynical money grabbing, and I do not for one blame Lucas entirely for that dizzy part of how it came about. Yeah, but you know, that would be like saying, well, this farmer planted a seed and the carrot grew out, but one day another seed blew into his field and created a carrot that poisons people, so I blame the farmer for planting that original carrot. No, I'm not going to do that.
I do think there's some gray area here too. I'm not going to go all in on bashing him and Spielberg for the modern blockbuster. What I will say is that Lucas purposefully targeted a very young audience with Star Wars.
Yeah.
Everything was about the 10-year-old audience. It was
One second. We've got a late person. Hey, Perry. Join us.
Sorry.
Well, you know, fella, guess what? We were just getting ready to wrap up the show, but we can certainly let you have your say. Don't worry. You also missed the funniest thing that's ever happened on Blog Talk Radio. Not us all getting raptured just as we're making the final statement on the great David Simon's TV universe. Oh, no. It was this.
It's better than that.
Blog Talk muted Aaron and I so we couldn't hear each other. And there were 2 minutes of dead silence on the live radio. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Perry Seibert. Aaron, finish up your thought, and then we'll let Perry have his say very quickly. We can, you know, instead of getting off now, I guess we'll have another half hour. That's awesome.
So the thing that I will say about Lucas and the modern blockbuster, as I was saying, he purposefully targeted Star Wars towards a very young audience. He was very much pressing, like, but will the 10-year-olds get it? And that was his thing. And that's fine for a movie, but it's become kind of like the Hollywood philosophy. We don't make movies for adults anymore. Blockbusters are for kids, and they have to be, or their parents won't come.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't think Lucas ever intended that. That was an unintentional consequence.
Unintended consequence, yes.
So yeah, we were just talking Perry about Lucas's legacy and influences. So we'll go right back to you. So for you, what is his legacy and what are his influences?
The legacy is Star Wars, quite obviously. I think that's pretty much inarguable. To the world at large, to filmmaking in general, it's Skywalker sound and it's Industrial Light and Magic, right? I mean, that's...
Yep.
He set the standard. We're all following that standard. Still, it's real good. And for that, I give him all the credit in the world. But, you know, when you decide to sell your greatest creation to Disney, you've decided to give up on your legacy a little bit. So there's that, too.
Well, you know, let me put it this way. I don't want to be crass or money-grabbing, but if some company offered me $5 billion so that I could sit at home and still collect royalties, ladies and gentlemen, I'd fucking do it, too, probably. Especially since I was already sitting on several billion dollars.
I know you well enough to know you wouldn't bitch about the decisions they were making about it also. You would cash that check quietly and go away. So I don't
know.
I don't know.
You know, when I have that much money, I might feel that I didn't need to keep my mouth shut because they'd say, you know what? You need to keep your mouth shut. And I'd say, really? Okay. And then I burn $1 million to say, see? Oh, you really want to see how much more I can burn? Here's another 100,000.
What's distressing to me about this with Lucas is he is like the prime example of everything that is wrong, not with Hollywood, but with, you know, he's a masterful technician. He is a filmmaker in the broadest sense of the word, but he's not a director. And he's not an artist because he had all the money in the world given to him, and he still doesn't want to go make something that is his equivalent of Youth Without Youth. He doesn't want to go make Tetro. He has it. He could burn it. I mean, the first prequel trilogy are the most expensive independent films ever made. No one was telling him what to do. That's what he wanted to do. That's the problem with the legacy. Like,
we were discussing that earlier.
What is your interest in that?
We were discussing it earlier, but I like the way you put that, that it's the most expensive independent film trilogy ever. You know, Aaron had pointed out, and I agreed, that, you know, he really didn't listen to anybody, and he probably should have went along somebody other than, say, Carrie Fisher to do his writing, to do the assisting, because, like I said, she may be the only script doctor to have a positive reputation as such, in which every patient is dead.
She's a better writer than that, but okay.
Oh, she may be a better writer than that. In maybe the one or two novels she wrote, but her scripts, I want to gouge my eyes and ears out when I look at Bonfire of the Vanities and Star Wars Episode II. I don't think it's any wonder that the two wonderful writers that did Catastrophe told Carrie Fisher, "Oh no, we'll give you your lines on set." They didn't want her fucking it up.
Fair.
But that's just me, and again, I don't want to bash her too badly, but I'm not a fan of her writing, at least in connection with, you know, Star Wars and a few other things. It's irksome, but that's kind of beside the point.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had gone through quite a bit of other stuff, and one of the questions was, what do you think his greatest strengths and weaknesses are as a director?
I think his greatest weakness is he doesn't care about people. He's not interested in people. He's interested in machines. And I think his greatest strength is this sounds really sarcastic, and I don't mean it to be. He knows talent. He knows the people to put around him who can do really great work. He is a fantastic producer in that capacity. And again, that's why I do think he's a filmmaker. I just don't think he's an artist or much of a director, quite frankly. Because
yeah, I think he tried.
I don't
to
know
be,
what he wants
you know,
to
I think
do
he tries, but I don't think it succeeds.
I don't think he even tries.
You don't think he tried a little bit with his earliest work?
Yes. Oh yeah. I think he tried. And I think that there's interest in that effort, but I still think he's more interested in the cars than the people in American Graffiti. And so I'm like,
well, you know, I think it's very obvious, and Aaron and I
did
discuss this too. Go on. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, it was just, and Aaron and I discussed this too, that even Star Wars has a lot of that American Graffiti DNA in it. I mean, what are the sand speeders and the pod races in the prequel trilogy than all the car shit from American Graffiti in sci-fi garb?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I do love, for me, the quintessential Lucas story is, you know, that they screen American Graffiti and the studio hates it, even though it just played really great in the house, and Coppola basically humiliates the studio head because he says, "I'll buy it from you right now. I will buy it back in full, and we will go take it somewhere else." And it's like, and that's Lucas's genius. He surrounds himself with really good people, and he's a really hard worker. He knows he's gifted beyond belief. He's James Cameron without the ambition, and that's you know. James Cameron's only saving grace is his ambition, and even I'm sick of it. I don't care anymore, but I admit it. He's got it.
Okay, I'm going to take this opportunity right here because it needs to be said. Fuck Avatar 2. Yeah, I didn't like that film, ladies and gentlemen, and folks, and other assorted human beings.
I didn't like it so much, I didn't bother to see it. I knew I didn't.
Well, you know, the thing is I decided, shit, they actually fucking nominated this for Best Picture. God damn it, if I want to push my streak to 5 years of seeing every single film nominated for an Oscar, not, because I was honestly thinking, you know, 5 years would be cool, but I don't need to put myself through that. I can live with just four. And then I was like, no, five would really be cool. Five would really be cool. And then they fucking nominate that shit, and I'm forced to fucking see it. Here's the thing, Wakanda Forever. You know, and this all goes in because, without George Lucas and Star Wars and such, none of this would be a thing because, you know, Hollywood would have found something else to make money off of. But Wakanda Forever, in the first 10 minutes, I knew Wakanda Forever was going to be 400 times, maybe even better at handling colonialism and all those assorted issues as opposed to what Cameron did in Avatar. But I will say this. I can't help but wonder if Lucas might have made a less racist film than Avatar 2. Because I really think that James Cameron is fucking tone deaf.
Yeah. Yeah, I at this point, I genuinely loathe Cameron. I'm like, you're not going to ever do anything that interests me ever again. So fine, make your little Smurfs movies. That's great. You do that, I don't have to pay attention to them. That's fantastic.
Oh, come on. The Smurfs are great. The Na'vi are not.
Still don't want to see movies with either of them.
Hey, Gargamel would be cool maybe not. I guess they did have that horrible live action Smurf film, but my Jesus Christ. I keep forgetting about that. I tried to blot the memory out.
But I think it is worth comparing Cameron and Lucas. I think they are really similar in broad aspects. And I wish that Lucas, that Cameron has never made a film as interesting as THX. Okay.
No.
He's made very good.
But he's also never made a film to me as culturally important as the first Star Wars, or come up with an idea as resonant as Indiana Jones. And I mean resonating with audiences in terms that where, you know, it's lasted for nearly 50 years and people are going to be talking about it in another 50 years because, let's be honest, people are already forgetting about Terminator, and in 10 years when the Avatar films are done, the only reason anyone's going to remember them is they were up for Best Picture because money, and they sit at the top of the grossing films list. Otherwise, no one's going to give a shit.
If you give me, if you will allow me to play the what if game that there were no Star Wars sequels, I would argue that Titanic is as much of a cultural imprint as Star Wars.
You know, I I may grant you that. And I honestly do think that Titanic may be his best film, though I really do enjoy True Lies. I think that it's very obvious that both James T. Curtis and Arnold Schwarzenegger were having a ton of fun with that movie, and it shows. But
Cameron hates women,
you know,
and other races. That's what we learn from True Lies.
We do. But at the same time, I just get the sense of fun from the two actors, and it's infectious. Even though I'm not saying it's a great movie. No, Titanic is obviously probably his best work, but Yeah, True Lies.
No, Terminator
that,
2 is his best work.
You think so? You really think so? Even
yes.
more than Aliens?
Yes.
Because I actually think the Terminator 2... I've always thought that Terminator 2, yeah, it's a good movie, but, you know, for what it is, but Aliens... Aliens is one of those rare sequels that may be better, or at least more advancing.
Yeah, Aliens
first.
Is probably a little bit better.
Yeah.
But both of them are, you know, great.
Allow me one more comparison here. I would argue that Lucas has never done a film as so wonderfully trying to tell us something about himself and not quite knowing how to do it, but I love the failed attempt to do so, that is The Abyss, which I think is by far the most interesting Cameron film.
So
for that,
bad,
I think it's the only time he acted like an artist, where he
I
was really
pro-
trying
I
to get at, God, why
the
can't
abyss.
I stay married? Why can't I stay married? and if you look at it
why can't he stay married? Because he's a fucking asshole.
Yo, yeah.
Maybe that'd be better.
But you know, I think that it's honestly, you know, we're on the subject of misogyny. And I mentioned earlier, and I had even said I wish Perry was here because I'd love to get his thought. We were talking about Lucas tinkering with Star Wars, and you know, going back and re-editing it. And I have to wonder if part of his motivation in editing it and then suppressing the original cut wasn't a bit of a middle finger to Marcia, to his ex-wife.
Maybe. I mean, I don't think that's an unfair reading, but
at the same time, I just think that that's his, you know, I think he allows himself to play in this universe consistently because he doesn't know anything else to do. He has no ambition. And so, yeah, let's go back and look at this again. Yeah, this is good. Yeah, this is fun. Let's tinker with it this way. It's different than the reasons Coppola can't stop tinkering. Coppola still thinks perfection is possible, or at least he accepts that he's gotten older and wants to kind of approach the material a little differently. You know, that's the problem, is none of these recuts of Star Wars change anything that matters outside of Greedo shooting first. You know, that's
oh, fuck
that matters. Right, exactly.
Because Han shot first, damn it.
Exactly. It's not interesting otherwise.
So and that's what makes Han a lovable rogue.
Exactly.
Although, let's be honest, Greedo, you know, I don't blame Han because Greedo was going to whack him.
Totally.
I mean, it's you know.
You shoot first, you know.
No. So, So where else were we? You know, we also talked about his this idea of him as an idea man. You know, that he thinks things up, then has others execute them. You know, which we talked about how it served him well as a mogul and the founder of a special effects house. So, what do you think of that? The idea that his best role is really coming up with these ideas and handing them off to others. You touched on that a little bit, but please expand.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think there's a reason everybody agrees that Empire's the best Star Wars movie. You pass it off and let people run with it. He comes up with Indiana Jones and then says, yes, Steven, take it. Let's give it to Lawrence Kasdan and Philip Kaufman, real writers, to write this script. Yes, absolutely. He's a producer extraordinaire. Not to say I love everything he produces, but yes, I think that's a significant talent.
You know, we were also talking about this earlier, and I'm now reminded of a story where, you know, Spielberg said that he had talked to George Lucas about wanting to direct a James Bond movie, this movie and that movie. And of course, Lucas said, "No, I've got a better idea than that. I've got Indiana Smith," which became Indiana Jones. But the part that most people haven't heard is that Lucas apparently told him, "I don't really have a script. I just have an outline. I know what I want to do in terms of how the character is going to behave." But he apparently told Spielberg, "I need someone else to direct this, and I need someone to write the script." So he damn well knows when his ego is not getting the best of him, when the hubris is not rising to epic proportions, that he's the guy that comes up with these awesome ideas and hands them off to other people. And, you know, that's perfectly fine. Sometimes that's what your role is.
And I would like to connect this back to something you guys were talking about when I called in and so rudely interrupted the fantastic conversation you were having. I do want to say that it's a matter of Lucas. Here's where I am at my most forgiving with him around Star Wars. Utter bullshit that he was tying this to, like, you know, grand ideas of myth and whatnot. Had no idea he was doing that. And it's not the fact that he was aiming it to kids necessarily. What I love about Star Wars, and I don't love the movie anymore, I never want to see it again, but what I fully grant is that Lucas loves that movie. Like, Lucas really was entertained by the movie that he made. I don't think it was pressed. It's like talking about Elton John, right? Elton John made spectacular pop music, in part because he really likes pop music. He's really good at making it. And so I have this, like, this bubble of understanding on Star Wars where, yes, I don't blame him. I don't blame Star Wars for causing the downfall of 70s cinema, just like I don't blame Jaws for it. But it is interesting that he doesn't know what to do after that. That he just stops having anything
he made the
movie
he needed
to do.
Right.
Sorry?
He made the movie he needed to make.
Yeah. And that he wanted to see, which is great.
So, and one last thing. Are there any themes in his films? So, Perry, I'll let you run with that.
I think we're on the midichlorian, right? That's where we are, right? That's pretty much the only recurring theme in all of them, right? I'm sure the midichlorian started with THX, right? If that hasn't happened yet, has that happened? Is your THX that's in there? I don't remember. No, he's not a thinker.
No, honestly, I don't think there really are any real themes. You know, there are pretenses to something greater, but ultimately I think any themes that we have in, say, the Indiana Jones movies are largely down to Spielberg and Ford's influences, Kaufman, Kasdan, I'm blanking on their names, the husband and wife team that wrote Temple of Doom.
Oh, you missed
and
it
then
when Bob I said
and the other guy on Last Crusade, like I said, Jeffrey Bohm,
Gloria
Carl Kuss, then there was another guy. Yep, him.
Gloria Katz and Willard Fiuk.
Well done.
Yep. So I, you know, and I'll be honest, I've always thought, not to bash anybody's belief system, because Star Wars seems to have become a religion almost literally, but it's really just warmed over pop Buddhist philosophy through a meat grinder of 50s Americana.
Yeah, the serious answer is probably nostalgia, right? At least with the best
work. Okay, I'll do that.
That's really what drives it. Like, not even if it's textual, but the fun of Star Wars is how much it's like the old serials that he was just trying to replicate the energy of. Like, it's not a slavish reproduction. It's, I would like to use some of those techniques to recapture for a modern audience what that's like, the excitement of that. And I think, American Graffiti is nothing but nostalgia.
Oh,
because
God,
American Graffiti
Go on. So I just had a weird something just occurred to me. Something just popped in my brain that made me think of something. But please continue.
No, go. I'd rather follow this. I was going to say
even though he's not really involved with the newest Star Wars movie, we have the original Indiana Jones, which were very much in the style of the old 30s adventure serials. We have Crystal Skull, which is very much a 50s B film. And now we have, as the details emerge on the newest Indiana Jones movie, which will likely be the last one, we have what appears to be a 70s weird time travel leftover Nazi Cold War fusion thing going on. Maybe this is his actual legacy, is mass nostalgia.
Yeah.
Never berries. I don't remember.
That is until
Star Wars.
Until Disney just opens up the pocketbooks now, because guess what? Short Round's got an Oscar. He can open the movie. He's the next Indiana Jones. This is obvious, right?
Well, here's what they do. They bring back Mutt. That was the joke.
That the whole thing. I thought Phoebe Waller-Bridge was going to be the new Indiana Jones, and that's actually serious.
Yeah. There have been serious rumors, but I am going to say something about that. All joking aside, one thing that I think people miss is it's in Crystal Skull. People say, well, Shia LaBeouf was not a believable greaser. Mutt wasn't supposed to be a believable greaser. That's not the point of that character. We know that he is, more learned, that he has, he's educated, he's had experiences in the world. In a lot of ways, he's like his father. And that's why when he does the whole, that's my mother you're talking about, don't talk about my mother that way. And
did we get muted again?
I can hear you. Aaron, can you hear me?
So it's just Adam that's gone this time?
I think so. Adam has been raptured.
Oh.
Obviously, the people at Skywalker Sound are not happy about whatever he's doing, and they have taken him away.
Well,
do you hear me now?
The lesson here is to never defend Indiana Jones 4.
Do you hear me now?
Yes. We hear
Do you hear me now?
Yes, keep on telling us how Shia LaBeouf was good in Indiana Jones 4. Yes, please.
No, I wasn't telling you how he was good. I was saying that the character is misunderstood as supposedly being a believable greaser when he was supposed to be a poser. I'm not saying that it works, but I'm saying the idea is that he's a poser.
Yes.
And, but I still think that it's a largely execrable film. You know, there are a couple of things in it that I like. I honestly think that it's a film that could have benefited from some tightening in a few places, but also expanding. I really feel, or should say, felt cheated at the end. I felt like that last act was extremely rushed. I think they spent too much time on the chase through the jungle that once we got to the final temple, they were just like, oh, shit, we've got to wrap it up.
Yeah.
You know, it felt like, and I can't remember what the movie was, but I remember this movie once where somebody took this long journey to go somewhere and do something fun, and when they got there, they had like 10 or 15 minutes, and they spent 10 or 15 minutes like speeding around on a bike, on like a motorbike, hitting all the sights real quick, and then having to hop on a plane and go home. and that's how that ending feels to me. It feels super fucking rushed. And let's not start with, let's just leave it at this, the fridge.
Oh, I actually like that sequence.
Oh, my God.
You know, here's
like
the quote. There's the thing. The fridge has two things. Yes, a lead-lined fridge would have protected him. But also getting blown that far inside of a fridge, no, he'd have been dead from the impact. He might have survived the nuking in terms of nukes, but
he also would have
getting
been,
blown
he,
away would have
vaporized.
He survived.
He also would have been vaporized from the heat.
Maybe.
He survived
and I said maybe.
So definitely.
He survived a power that could melt Nazis' faces. He's indestructible. We've proven this. There's no threat to his life at any point. Okay.
Guys, don't you remember? Don't you remember? He drank from the cup.
Exactly. Yes, there you go. That's perfectly logical. I love this argument.
And his father, who had obviously only recently fucking died in the 50s, should have probably been dead about 15 or 20 years earlier. So obviously that simple sip was all you needed. I don't think that knight was surviving on bread in there. I think he was taking a single sip every 5 years and going, ah, I have another decade.
Yeah, I don't think Jesus survived a nuclear blast going into a refrigerator, though.
And wouldn't that be a great movie for George Lucas to make? Come on, let's see.
No, James Cameron.
And
why not offend a few more
I'm
people?
I'm sure.
Yeah. No. You know. There's so much. You know. We could talk about here, but we've talked about so much of it already. But I do want to wrap this up. It's a shame you weren't able to be here for the first part, but it's been wonderful having you for the second, Perry.
My sincere apologies.
You know. No. You know. Things happen. Things happen. But now I'm going to have to get to the part of the show that we call housekeeping, and that is where I tell what's coming next. And tomorrow there is a St. Patrick's Day commentary watch, The Secret of Roan Inish, the John Sayles film. That is with Carl and Company. On the 19th, Rock This Town Radio with TC Rollover St. Patty. On the 20th of March, Deviant Legion promoting the upcoming New York City Sci-Fi Film Festival, which is happening on March 25th. And then on March 26th, there is going to be Rock This Town Radio with TC, 1973, a half century later. And once more on the second of April, Rock This Town Radio with TC, Beantown Rocks. Could that be something to do with Boston bands? Now, having done that, I will say that this show, Cathode Ray Mission, will be back in 2 weeks on March 31st with a look at the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, or as it's been known since Lucas altered it and put it on DVD, The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. Then 2 weeks after that, on the 14th of April, we will once more be back for a look at the career of director Jane Campion. So I hope that you folks out there will join us for those episodes. Once again, the Young Indiana Jones episode is in 2 weeks on March 31st. That's a Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern. Then the same time, 2 weeks later, April 14th, for a look at Jane Campion. And now I return to you guys, and I will ask you the final question, as I always do. Is there anything that we haven't brought up yet that you would like to before we sign off? And I'll start with you, Perry.
No, other than it's such an interesting thing to look at that group of filmmakers, right? To look at who he came up with and through. And if you do that, you realize how unambitious he was. And I don't mean for that to sound as cruel as it does, but like, you know, he does not have the passion of Milius. He doesn't have the talent of Coppola. He doesn't have the interest in people of Coppola. I mean, no one can do what Spielberg does. So that's, I don't ding him there, but it was so great for, you know, he's savvy enough to latch onto Walter Murch, who's a freaking genius. I sound so mean because I'm aggravated that someone who has that much talent around him and knows how to use it doesn't want to use it for anything of interest. He just wants to maintain.
Can I just add one thing here? Yeah, Walter Murch is a genius, and it's a damn shame he never directed another movie after Return to Oz, which I think is a really fine film.
It is. I agree.
Yeah, I showed it to my wife about 2-3 years ago. She'd never seen it, and she was like, wait, what? Whoa, this is dark. This is good. And I was like, yeah. She said, this lost money. I was like, yeah. She said, this is scary. I was like, uh-huh. So, Aaron, you, anything? Anything we haven't
Remember when he was supposed to be the one to direct Apocalypse Now?
Oh, God.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? That's all.
Yeah.
Now that you've reminded me of that, I'm thinking about that and going, oh, fuck. I think that literally would have killed Lucas.
Oh yeah,
it would have. He does. He wouldn't know what. Heck, can you picture Lucas mad? And I mean crazy. I don't mean like upset. I mean crazy. No, no. It might be Apocalypse Now, but it's not going to be the Apocalypse Now we all know.
Apocalypse Now is one of those movies that the first time I saw it, I was like, what the fuck did I just see? But every time I've seen it since, I'm like, you know, this may be one of the greatest films ever, but it's definitely not going to be for everybody because what a fucking fever dream.
it might be one of the greatest films ever, and I still don't know what the fuck I saw. The 14th time I saw it, I'm still not sure what it is.
And you can't say that you've ever had that experience with a Lucas movie or a Cameron movie. But you
right,
definitely
no, I know exactly what I saw.
With a Coppola film. You definitely have had that with even a Spielberg film. Spielberg's made some movies like that. That's how I felt the first time I saw The Terminal. I was like, what the hell did I just watch? That is one of the damn strangest little movies I've ever seen. And yet it's not one of my favorite Spielberg movies. I don't think it's one of his like top five films, but I love it for some reason. But, you know, there's the thing. There's what I was going to say. I think that Lucas, despite, you know, talking about having a personal investment in his films, it doesn't come across. I don't think I've ever sensed that personal investment that he claims to have. Now, I'm not denying that he feels that, but I am saying that for me, I don't sense that in his films. He may have it, but it's not there on the screen for me.
I tend to agree with that.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the most interesting way to look at the prequel trilogy is to understand that, like, I think it was his youngest son at the time the first one comes out is 7, and he's 10 when the second one comes out, and 13 when the third one comes out. And that's exactly the age that each of those films is aimed at. I think that's the only way to understand it's personal. I think he was making those truly independent films for his son, not even for him, which is sweet, if only it was worth watching.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I will say this, and I've said it before, including on this show, there's stuff in the prequel trilogy that I like. There's a lot that I hate. The best thing that the prequel trilogy gave us was Dave Filoni's Clone Wars series. Which, once you've seen that, you actually will appreciate both Attack of the Clones and especially Revenge of the Sith a whole hell of a lot more. But here's the problem with Revenge of the Sith. As good as it is in comparison to the other two prequels, it shouldn't take 6 or 7 seasons of watching these characters for you to finally give a shit about them when they die.
I actually think Sith is better than Jedi.
I'm going to say that
I have more of
an emotional attachment to Jedi, but I would probably have to say, putting on my thinking cap, my cinephile brain, yeah. Although I still think that Rogue One blows a lot of them out of the water. I'm a huge Rogue One fan.
We disagree, but I understand.
Well, part of what I liked about Rogue One is it fucked, just like I like Last Jedi for the same reason. I like the fact that it fucks with the fans. It takes Star Wars fans and it pokes holes in them. It drags them through the mud and it makes them scream and whine and go, no, this isn't how it's supposed to be. And there's nothing to me as satisfying in modern pop fandom as that, except for maybe the tears, the sweet, delicious, salty tears of Marvel fans when something goes wrong.
I love where you're coming from. I just wish that Rogue One didn't spend 30 minutes making me wonder if the Death Star is going to blow up. it just fails at a storytelling level for me because I don't give a fuck about the space battle for 30 minutes. It doesn't matter. I know they're going to blow the ship up. I don't care.
Yeah, well, but, you know, I think, you know, with that, we will, you know, and hey, you know, with that, we will have to sign off. It's been great having you guys. Thanks for joining us for the second hour, Perry. I will definitely see you for that Campion episode, right? You're going to set your alarm. You're going to sit there and wait.
At 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight. Can I blame the time change? Can I get away with that?
Well, you know, I will say this.
We are still in the first week.
We are all three in education. Let's just blame our students. Nah, we can't do that. They're delightful children. They really are. But you know, the teachers always wanna say, you know, we love our students, but they give us can't remember shit. Good old CRS.
It's true.
So, on the count of three, I want to thank everybody out there for listening. I want to thank you two for participating, and we will say good night. So, 1, 2, 3, good night, folks.
Good night.